We take it for granted sometimes, those intimate relationships as being part of our lives, and hopefully, most of the time at least, a constructive part of our lives. What effect do they actually have, those relationships, on our health? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. And with me is Lauren Papp. She's a professor with the School of Human Ecology at the UW-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Perhaps seems an obvious thing, but we don't want to look over or overlook anything in terms of defining our terms here, intimate relationships.
Sure. So when we think about intimate relationships, we're considering the close relationships in our lives that have sexual intimacy or the possibility of sexual intimacy. So these are, we usually think of longer-term partnerships, committed relationships with one person that we expect to endure over time. And these are a distinct aspect of our relationships, and they're emerging as uniquely linked to our health and well-being across our lifetime.
I suppose by now there must be a lot of data comparing people's health when they don't have an intimate relationship with those who do. I mean, the person who stays single for life.
Yes. So there's evidence that close relationships and social connections are valuable and critical across our lifespan. We also look more in depth at romantic relationships or intimate relationships and see that people who are married or remain in a long-term committed partnership over the course of their lifespan do look better on emotional health, physical health, productivity indicators, most indicators looked at. I think what might be less obvious that it's really the quality of those relationships that comes mm-hmm. out as being important, not so much the status, although in some studies status is important, but also looking at the quality of those relationships. So if we think that marriage or being in a close, committed relationship has some protective effects, those are only amplified when the relationship itself is high quality, positive, constructive, and we can talk about those.
And I don't know if this is the sort of thing you get into or not, Lauren, but if we look at the divorce rates mm-hmm. in the last 50, 60, 70 years and compare our health, do we have any kind of way of comparing that rising divorce rate with health?
Yeah. So that's interesting. Divorce rates have, I would say, overall leveled off. So we can confidently say they're not rising anymore for most age groups or demographics in the United States. Really interesting to that point was recent data that emerged just this past year that showed that among individuals in midlife, so in middle adulthood, those couples were actually experiencing increased divorces. So we have to be careful. It's not that overall divorces are more likely, but now we see this particularly vulnerable period where couples are in the midlife. So I think that needs a lot more attention. What we do see is that any time someone loses their marital status for any reason, divorce, death, separation, there's an immediate impact on health and people suffer health declines. Unfortunately for most people that, we see recovery after an adjustment period. But yes, losing the marital status is linked to poor health.
How about serial marriages?
Yes, that's a really interesting question. While divorce has become very common in our society, we also know that most people give it another shot. So after going through that process, many people get remarry again. So we have some interesting data on what happens. Do you kind of get better? Does your likelihood of staying together increase, as you've had more experience? And we see that actually later marriages have a greater likelihood of dissolving or ending
really?
Than first marriages. Oh, yeah, and there's mm-hmm. probably a few reasons for that. First of all, people who have already been divorced know that it's a viable option. I made it through, and you know what? I can do it again, and it will be a painful process to be sure, but there is that chance that maybe there's just still someone else out there. So people know that it's an option. Second, if an individual brought a characteristic or part of their personality, something about their experiences that made it harder for them to be in a successful relationship, if that aspect of their history or their personality hasn't gotten worked out, it's going to affect every relationship that they're in. So those enduring characteristics that might contribute to a divorce or dissolution need to be resolved. And then another key reason that's emerged is that a lot of times those later marriages involve the blending of families, children from different relationships, and that can get complicated and may be, you know, a new source of problems that are in that relationship.
Well, it does raise an interesting question. If for example, you, quote, inherit or marry into a family with several growing children.
Yes.
And you're trying to, in a divorce situation, for example, you're trying to, in some ways, replace the parent that they have grown up with. You're asking for a lot.
Yes, there's a lot there. And particularly if these are families that have come together for divorce, it's not, the replacement is not as likely as the addition or the additive effect of having another parent come into the mix for that growing child. So there can often be competition or alliances, and those are definitely hard to navigate and, not surprisingly, can take a toll on the partner's relationship.
Relationship, statistical relationship between age at first marriage and durability of said marriage?
You know, that's a great question. I think that as we've seen the average age of first marriage increasing, there are some benefits to that. People may come into their marriage knowing, okay, I've had some prior experiences, maybe I know what works now for me. But we see the demographic predictors aren't as important as kind of the internal workings of a relationship in determining what works and what doesn't. So, you know, in my work, we tend to look at the very specific processes or exchanges between couples and those factors. So how couples relate to each other, how people work on their differences with their partner. Those internal processes, I think, are much more interesting and valuable for thinking, okay, how is this relationship going?
But they're likely to be different processes at the age of 20 than at the age of 30.
Very likely, yes. Yes.
And marriage, the age at first marriage, that is going up?
Yes, it has been going up.
And so is that a good thing?
You know, that may be part of, just speculating here, that may be part of why we've seen the overall divorce rate holding steady across most demographics, because people are coming into this with more experiences. Many people now have lived with a romantic partner before starting the relationship. And so that could be one reason. Maybe everybody's on average a little bit more experienced. But I think as the midlife data show, you know, how couples in midlife are seeing increases in the divorce rate, it's not age alone that's going to protect us. So we have to work on that relationship and make sure it stays strong in order to endure, especially as people live longer and longer.
Well, let's get right down to it, this business of the relationship itself, which
sounds
seems
good.
To be your prime interest, and it's probably the prime interest of everybody listening for that matter. So if you're 20, 22, 25, say, how do you know how to avoid a relationship? How do you know which person to choose?
Yes, yes. And that's a great question. And what happens, we're seeing now, what happens during our 20s is becoming so important. There seems to be this shift in sort of when adulthood starts and when we're, you know, making these major decisions for the first time. And there's research that shows, you know, who we're with, what our relationships are like, what our educational and career experiences are like. What we do in our 20s completely sets people up for how they transition to adulthood and what those trajectories look like. So I don't think we can understate the importance of early intimate relationships, our first romantic relationships, and those very, you know, people might think, oh, those are just fun, you know, just flings or, you know, experiments to try. But those early experiences are so important in shaping what we expect to happen in our future relationships. They kind of give us these examples of, okay, here's what my partner will do, here's what I do, and they just shape our expectations for years to come. Sometimes those intimate relationships that are, you know, happening in our early 20s or during our college years, those might turn into our long-term partnerships that eventually go on to form families in many cases. But even if those don't, even if there's some change, those experiences are still very meaningful and have long-lasting impact.
So how does a person know who to get attached to?
Yes.
And how much to commit?
Yeah. So is your partner somebody who you respect? Is your partner someone who makes you feel good about yourself? Does your relationship with your partner let you be the best person you can be? Or as a young adult, and so there's usually a large social network around that couple relationship, do you see conflicts with your partner? Are you having conflicts with your partner over, you know, you spending time with friends as opposed to just your partner? Is your partner putting pressure on you to focus on the relationship and ignore things like education or career goals? And all of those questions are really important. We know that there's this strong interconnection between what your partner does and how healthy your partner is and how healthy you can be. So if your partner is engaging in behaviors, substance abuse behaviors or other risky practices that don't feel good to you or things that you've seen, you know, haven't worked out well for you or other people, those are really serious indicators to consider because a lot of those behaviors don't change over time. So those early stages of a relationship can give a lot of important information.
Well, that raises a couple of big themes, doesn't it, Lauren? Mm-hmm. One is this person has some elements, some personality traits that I don't like, but maybe he or she will change, or maybe I can change that person.
Yes. Well, that's a tall order to try to change somebody who's, you know, brought their experiences. And it's not to say relationships can be wonderfully corrective experiences. So people who have had more negative experiences with relationships prior to this romantic relationships, including problematic family relationships, we can learn and grow a lot in our relationships. And I believe that can happen, you know, well into our adulthood. That can last a lifetime. But if somebody is, you know, seems very jealous or insecure or continues to persist in higher risk behaviors that don't feel comfortable to you, a lot of those behaviors and patterns are harder to change.
Well, yeah, I know, for instance, a case where a woman marries a man without knowing that he has substance abuse mm-hmm. issues mm-hmm. and maybe PTSD thrown in on mm-hmm. top of that, and then once committed, thinks that she can help him through these. And of course, if she can or whenever she can, that makes her feel better. But in the aggregate, the relationship fails.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard work too. So we know that individuals who are married to somebody with a drinking problem, for example, tend to be unhealthy themselves because that's, you know, that's an additional kind of strain on that person to try to take care of somebody else. We tend to idealize our partners. It feels really good for us if our partner is great and our relationship is going well. So we have some biases that make us put our partner in the best light possible, and that can help us a lot. So if that helps us overlook some misunderstandings or minor things, that's good. But it may also be important to kind of check in. How do your friends and family members see this relationship? Do people seem concerned by the amount of time that you're spending with your partner relative to other important aspects of your lives? Do people express concern about some of your partner's behaviors? Because sometimes we miss those, and they may be clear to other people. So I think going with how you feel and your perceptions of your partner, but also being open to hearing, you know, if somebody is trying to express some concerns.
Is there such a thing as love at first sight?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. I believe so completely. I think what happens are the start of our romantic relationships can be just completely exhilarating. Everything is new. We're learning so much about this new person who in turn is also teaching us kind of about ourselves. And we're just expanding so much. It's a very exciting time. The challenge is, because nobody thinks this relationship then can end, the challenge is, what do we know and what can we do to keep those high levels of satisfaction and excitement continuing beyond those early stages?
What's going on physiologically with somebody who's in the initial stages of falling in love?
Yes, a lot. Our brain is changing. Our hormones are changing. We're actually syncing up to the partner. One of the indicators of, you know, if people are going to get together is when they're first meeting and the first few times they're talking to each other. Do we take on sort of their behaviors? Do we unconsciously mimic? And that synchrony can actually be one of the things that starts a relationship, because people feel very in tune with their new partner.
You can develop a common language and a common culture, can't you, that would be just shared by the two of you?
Definitely. New language. You can come up with new kind of words or nicknames for each other or for parts of your lives. And there's a lot of just that newness is very exciting. And the goal is to have novelty throughout your relationship, to always kind of bring you back to that start.
Wouldn't that sort of burn you out? If you're constantly on, you know, in the thrall of being in love.
Yes, no, and we don't see those levels of excitement enduring throughout. But over time, you know, there are different kinds of love and different kinds of attraction. So as people continue on in their relationship, that passionate love can be joined and eventually maybe taken over a little bit by companionate love and the bonds that you form together. But that history and that initial, I think, you know, what happens during that initial attraction can be important throughout.
What part does insecurity play in the thrill of early love?
Yeah, so insecurity can come into play if we see partners kind of losing their own identity or not holding on to their personal identity. So a relationship should not substitute or try to fill in anything that you're missing. I think our relationships do best when they're enhancing what both partners bring to the relationship. And so if one person feels like, oh, I have to let this really important part of myself go for this relationship to continue, that can be a loss or a sign that there would be problems ahead. If both people can maintain their interests and their identities and their ongoing relationships, then we see that romantic relationship just being a place where the partners can thrive and grow together.
So if I'm a race car driver, but my beloved doesn't like going to races and maybe even worries about me in races and can't stand to have me race,
yeah,
I have to decide what to give up.
Yes. So maybe that's not such a central part of your life. And to the extent that race car driving is maybe risky, that could help. That could be one of the ways that our relationships offer protection to our health, our physical and emotional health. So I think the question there is, you know, what does the race car driving mean to you? Is it a central part of your identity? And is it something that in the long run, if you temper that a little bit, will you still be okay with that?
Well, on the other side too, though, how central is that disdain for it a part of the other person's
life? Exactly. And if your partner were to start to criticize you for the race car driving or not be able to talk about anything else without bringing up that race car driving, that would be a problem. Yeah, so it would go beyond just the issue of the behavior.
How about jealousy? How healthy is jealousy?
So jealousy is a problematic behavior. I think sometimes people find it flattering when somebody is really concerned about their whereabouts or, persisting on finding out where they've been, who they're spending their time with. But jealousy, as you've indicated, it does reflect a sense of insecurity. It is likely to make partners, kind of very aware of how they're spending their time, what they're doing. you quickly know when your partner is trying to check up on you versus calling really just to see how you're doing. And so jealousy is not a healthy sign. There are many other positive ways that someone can express their interest and their concern for you. Jealousy usually reflects something about the person's own insecurities rather than the good of the relationship.
And maybe a distrust of that other person.
Exactly, a distrust. And people don't always realize that sometimes those jealous inquiries and all of those accusations, where were you, why were you with those person, with that person, a lot of times that actually leads to a self-fulfilling prophecy where the person who's being checked up on finally says, fine, if you don't believe me or if you really think I'm doing something, you know, I might as well. So jealousy is not a healthy way to express your interest in someone.
We'll look further at this relationship between intimacy and your health when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Lauren Papp, and we're looking at the relationship between intimate relationships and your health. And we've talked a little bit about just recently insecurity, jealousy, for example, in a relationship and how that can be detrimental. And, of course, that opens this whole Pandora's box, doesn't it, Lauren, of
yes.
conflict in a relationship.
Yes, and very widely studied topic. Anytime we're talking about relationships, even intimate relationships, we have to talk about conflict because it would be impossible to maintain a close and enduring and important connection with somebody without experiencing conflict. So there's, you know, we can't minimize or get rid of the conflict, but we can definitely talk about ways and strategies that handling conflicts are better relative to not.
Okay, let's take an example. I guess I don't want to start too drastically and say, what if the other person is, you know, having a relationship with a third person? We can maybe get into that a little bit later.
Yes. Yeah.
But more likely the sort of conflicts that would come up every day.
In day-to-day life, mm-hmm. exactly. And those differences are very common. When we look at what couples report happening in their homes, we see, you know, usually at least one of these differences or disagreements comes up per day. And what we've learned through looking at couples in their home, as well as in laboratory research settings, is that there are constructive ways of handling conflict. Those are what you would think of as positive strategies, things that help the couple work towards conflict resolution. And then there are more destructive ways of handling conflict. A key difference between constructive and destructive ways of handling conflict is, are the strategies, are the behaviors that the partner's engaging in, are they going to lead to the problem at hand being reduced or being resolved? So when we look at, let's start with constructive. Constructive strategies include things like listening to your partner's point of view, working on problem solving, coming up with strategies that would get rid of that problem. We want to keep the door open for our partner to be able to express their needs and where they see the need for change. And working on that issue. So other constructive strategies are could include even using physical or verbal affection during conflict to remind your partner that you're there for them.
That could be a challenge, couldn't it, if you're already in the kind of fuming stage?
Yes. But maybe even just another relatively constructive strategy would be to say, okay, let's come back to this later if things have already become heated, and to recognize, okay, this is an issue. It's not going to – we don't need to let it spill over into, you know, our entire day. So let's, you know, take some time and we'll come back and acknowledge that something still needs to be resolved. destructive strategies, but the focus there is that you're keeping your discussion, you're keeping that conflict interaction focused on whatever the issue is at hand. So you have different points of view of something, you don't see eye to eye, or something your partner does just simply annoys you. You know, you need to come back and try to work on that. Destructive conflict strategies tend to be strategies, behaviors that take away from the issue. They kind of leave the issue and don't lead to conflict being resolved. So you may cut your partner off or kind of end the discussion so your partner doesn't have time to air their concerns. You can listen in a very distracted way, so not give your partner your full attention, change the topic without acknowledging or validating their concerns. So those are strategies that don't let the issue, you know, get resolved.
Right.
Worse even are the destructive strategies that move away from the issue or the difference at hand and make this discussion more personal. So you may turn, you know, an annoyance that you see in your partner, something they're doing that's annoying you. You can start saying things like, you always do this behavior, or you never remember to follow through, and start to take one instance or one thing that you'd like to change and really generalize it and make it much more about your partner. Whenever we see personal insults or personal attacks or very critical behaviors, those are the most destructive ways to try to work through a difference. Because not only is that initial annoyance or difference not going to be resolved, but you are, you know, that experience, that negativity is going to stay with your relationship and likely influence how you handle the next difference.
It could make it more difficult, in fact.
It makes it much more difficult. And partners, you know, can get into a cycle where they quickly learn, this is how we deal with our differences. Our differences continue to pile up. And sort of that baseline of, or that acceptability of what's, you know, what you can say. It just, the ante kind of goes up and up and up.
Well, that person, the other person, could get increasingly sensitized to this whole issue, and the minute even some indirectly related thing comes up,
exactly,
could flare up.
Exactly. And that's when we look at couples who are generally unhappy in their relationship compared to couples who are happy in their relationship. We see major differences in how these unhappy or distressed couples handle their differences. And one of the differences is exactly that anytime there's a difference or some issue, you know, partners quickly get to this cycle of negativity where, you know, just one little comment or interaction can set off this negative pattern. And as couples have been unhappy for a longer period of time, they quickly get to this negativity and it just gets more negative. We see couples looking, kind of keeping track and keeping score. So there's this sense of tit for tat, you know, where they feel justified. They can quickly have a rebuttal. And that's a cycle that's very difficult to break.
Difference between the genders in resolving conflict?
You know, it's interesting. Sex and gender differences have been an area of interest. And we used to see studies would show, women are much more likely to be kind of the demanding person and have all these areas of change, while male partners tended to be the ones who wanted to avoid the conflict or not have that discussion. And newer research that, again, kind of goes beyond this demographic indicator of sex or gender looks at, well, whose issue are we trying to resolve? And we see that if we're looking at both men's and women's areas of desired change, that both people can be sort of that initiator or the person who is seeking change. When their partner, male or female, is doing more of the withdrawing and not dealing with the issue, that's problematic. So if one person is kind of pushing or trying to make a change and the other person is avoiding that issue, that's a problematic pattern, whether or not, you know, the male or female is pushing for the change.
So obviously part of it's communication, but of course there has to be also some substance there. I mean, some real reason that I would complain.
Yes.
And
yes.
Some real reason that that other person would address it.
Yes, and exactly. And that, again, gets to the question of, is the couple working on conflict resolution of a particular change, you know, of a particular change or issue to be addressed? Or is this more just, this is how we talk, you know, we're never on the same page and we're always trying to kind of one-up each other?
Well, that's another thing that must vary from couple to couple. And, of course, we have a lot of bicultural couples in the country now.
Yes.
You know, always have had a lot, but more than ever. And that is the level of apparent conflict that mm-hmm. might be just part of the persona, part of the culture.
Yes. And I think that relates to expressiveness
yeah.
and communication.
Right.
And so what we need to look at, because expressing differences, that alone is not a problem, particularly if the person who's expressing differences is also really high on expressing the positives, too. So I think that it's almost a ratio or, you know, just the pluses and minuses that you consider. Well, my partner's expressing a lot of areas of change or a lot of issues, but then they're also very expressive in their positivity.
Loud too.
Yes, exactly. And so if the positivity is there along with, you know, and it matters how are the differences being expressed, because you can express your difference in positive ways. And you can pick up on that when your partner is expressing their discontent. You know, is it just about the issue that needs to change? Or again, are they blaming you? And is this more of a personal attack?
What are the most common issues then that become these sources of conflict?
Yeah. So not surprisingly, when we're looking at couples who are living with children, so couples with children in the home, children tend to emerge as the most frequent area of disagreement, followed by chores. So just the issues that come up day to day. We see that couples who live with children, you know, engage in most of their, almost half of their conflicts, about 40% of the conflicts that happen in day-to-day family life then deal with children. And perhaps that's not surprising. Children have, there are a lot of decisions that need to be made around children. As children grow up and become more independent, you know, they're more, just more decisions and more issues to be worked through. We've done some investigation of, well, what does that mean if children are a source of their parents' disagreements? And does that matter to children? And that's a really important question. Children from a very young age are motivated by this goal of keeping a sense of security in their family. So
probably number one.
Absolutely. Children want to know that their family is a place where things are going to be safe, where people are there for them, and where, you know, they don't have to constantly worry about, okay, is this going to end? Is somebody going to leave?
And will I have to go somewhere else?
Exactly, exactly. Those are central questions in children's development. So children are very motivated to maintain the sense of security in their family. So when we saw that, you know, 40%, almost 40% of parents' disagreements involved the children or were about the children, we thought we needed to look at those further and see, you know, what are children being exposed to?
Is it more than that, by the way, if it's a second marriage?
You know, in the study that I am drawing from, we did not have enough of the different relationship types to really explore that. So I think that's a question that definitely warrants its own investigation. What we did see is that even though, you know, 40% of parents' disagreements included children as a topic, parents do still try to protect their children from seeing these disagreements. So actually, most disagreements don't occur in front of the children. So parents, you know, we tend to have some sense, okay, if we're working through something, you know, maybe some of this is best kept for when we're alone.
Sure.
And parents do effectively do that. What was concerning with our results, though, is that of the subset of conflicts to which children were exposed, not only were those most likely about children, but children were seeing a subset of conflicts that were not handled well. Parents were using more of the destructive expressions than the constructive expressions. And those results have implications, you know, for how safe children feel. So children, when conflict is not handled well, children, even from very young ages, pick up on that and they, you know, take on that negativity. They understand that things have not been resolved. Also, we know that what children, you know, see in their homes can be a very effective tool for their own lives. So it's unfortunate if children, you know, are seeing the subset of differences that is not handled well. And it's a missed opportunity in a sense, because those destructive strategies can have an impact on how children feel and how they engage with others in their own lives.
So, for example, child has disobeyed.
Mm-hmm.
Father says, well, we need to address this once and for all, and so child does not get Christmas presents. And mother says, no, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. Too destructive. And he'll never recover mm-hmm. from it. So they have to come to terms with that somehow.
Yep, yep. And so, you know, again, it makes sense that the child would be there for that discussion, right? Because it was their behavior that prompted that. The child now turns to, well, whatever they were doing, you know, that maybe caused them to act out or try a new behavior that they weren't sure how it would go over. Now the child turns to wondering, you know, well, this child would be wondering, am I going to get these Christmas presents or not? Probably. But also, you know, how are my parents going to work this out? I've now introduced this situation, and my parents clearly aren't seeing eye to eye. And we see systematic differences in how children respond to that. So if the discussion between the parents isn't going well, children usually try to do something to intervene. It could be misbehaving again to distract the parents away. You know, okay, let's get out of that discussion and come back to me. Other children will try to help out and intervene. Some children will kind of joke or play and try to distract their parents in a positive way. So, and all of those can reflect, well, how much is this child, you know, now concerned about what's going on between the parents?
Child could also play one parent against the other.
Definitely, especially if they've seen that strategy work before. And a lot of how children respond, you know, does draw from their previous experiences. So if children know that this is not going to end well, they've seen similar discussions between the parents end up, you know, in very negative, with negative behaviors or lasting for a long time, then the child has kind of an increased sense of, okay, I need to do something here to try to end this. And a lot of it depends on what they've seen work before.
Well, that has to be the most complicated of the conflicts when it involves children. But what about something that would be, I think, also very commonly cited? And that would be money.
Yes. Yeah. So money and money is a high source of conflict. It's a frequent source of conflict, including in couples. You know, we were talking about young adults and even in earlier relationships, maybe before children are present. So, yes, we know that money decisions are very important. And a lot of our most, if you think about, you know, most of your major financial decisions will be made in the context of an intimate relationship for many people. So it's hard to tease apart money in our relationships. Another interesting thing about when we're considering money conflicts, we're also bringing in a lot of family history usually, because many of us learn or don't learn financial strategies or you know, we kind of follow what we have seen work or not work in our own families. So a lot of times, you know, in romantic relationships, you have the partners working on an issue that also really brings in some family experiences as well. So what we see when couples report having money conflicts, and in our studies that have looked at couples in what they discuss in their homes, about 20% of conflicts that occur in couples' homes deal with money. So that's fairly substantial. Conflicts about money tended to last longer than discussions of other issues. Conflicts about money tended to come up more often. So while some topics you can resolve and that may be the end of the issue for a while, we were seeing that, you know, a couple who had a money conflict on one day was likely to have another money conflict in that, you know, same two-week period that we were studying. Conflicts about money have high importance to couples' relationships. Again, I think because their money issues are touching on really personal kind of core values. This is how I've always been. This is how I've grown up. Money conflicts often kind of invoke feelings of power or maybe imbalance in the relationship. And when couples were trying to work on their money disagreements, the partners engaged in more angry and depressive behaviors. And those are specific types of destructive behaviors. So angry behaviors included things like yelling, using personal insults, and depressive behaviors included things like being sad or crying during a conflict. So we see some fairly negative behaviors used. Interestingly, though, couples did endorse using more problem solving during money issues compared to conflicts about other topics. So taken together, that paints a picture. Couples are working on their money conflicts. They come up pretty often. And if you have a money conflict, it's likely to come up again. But they're not being handled very well with these destructive behaviors being more frequent, more relied on here. So I think there's some reasons for this. You know, I mentioned the family history, possible power dynamics. I think money conflicts, you know, you're often dealing with some external pressures here. So while some issues like a couple's intimacy conflicts, those may be known to nobody else in the entire world but the partners themselves.
But if the electric bill hasn't been paid, it becomes apparent to
everybody.
You're going
to hear about it. Exactly. Yeah. And not only are you getting, you know, reminders and increased penalties if you can't make a payment or something, but yes, it could affect your entire family if you have to move or make major changes to your household. So I think money, it's important to understand how couples handle their money, and definitely an area where couples can be proactive in this area. So talk about money, work on financial decisions together early on, even before it becomes a major issue.
Well, we'll look at some other issues, a few other issues, and conflict resolution in these intimate relationships when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Lauren Papp. We're looking at the relationship between health and intimate relationships. And when we talk about conflict in any kind of relationship, a lot of times part of that is anger. And it seems to me that over the course of time, that anger really can lead to depression, can't it?
Absolutely. We know that people who are in romantic relationships with higher levels of conflict are more likely to experience mental health symptoms, including depression and other indicators of psychological distress.
So, how do you break that cycle? How how big a part does a sense of humor play in this whole relationship health?
Sense of humor can be great, but if you're familiar with the signs of depression, having lower levels of positive affect, not having the energy to do what you usually like to do, you know, finding that humor can be a very difficult task. So when one partner has more depression, you know, they feel lower or they feel more upset themselves. And that often, you know, spills over into the couple's relationship in very obvious ways. So we know that people who are in a relationship and they're feeling more depressed, they tend to engage in more reassurance seeking. So they're kind of asking their partner for more evidence that things are going well. They're looking for more feedback because they're not feeling good about how things are going. And so you can imagine if your partner suddenly or over time has become, you know, more doubtful about the relationship or less sure of themselves, it's up to you as their partner to kind of make up for that and start, you know, providing some of those answers and reassurance. And that can take a toll on you. People who have more depression symptoms are often evaluating themselves more harshly than they normally would and more negatively. They also, though, can interpret their partner's behavior as more negative as well. So
toward them.
Exactly. So they have these, you know, it's harder for them to see things in a positive way. So that kind of raises the bar for the partner to need to go over the top and, you know, have all of these positive signs come through. They can be doing positive things, but they may not be perceived that way by the person who's feeling more depressed.
So how do you get a better perspective on things? You go on a trip, take a walk, go to a movie, or hopefully not a depressing one?
Yeah, no. So those, I mean, behavioral activities, just changing your behaviors can be one possibility. The connection between our depression and our relationships is so strong that couples counseling can be an effective way of dealing with an individual's depression. So if, you know, if the relationship is suffering, then talking with somebody who, you know, can deal with the mental health issues can help your relationship and help the person who's feeling depressed.
Of course, first you have to be able to identify the problem before you can seek a solution.
Exactly.
Well, so in terms of the progression, or let's say the progress of a relationship, mm-hmm. one that may have gotten a little static at best and maybe contentious at worst, what do you actually do to just turn it around? I mean,
yeah, well, it's harder. So if things have already gotten to this point where couples are in very negative cycles and interacting in those negative ways that we talked about, that's going to take a real dedicated effort and many times require the help of an outside person to help the couple kind of work through, okay, where are these communication patterns coming from? How can we kind of remove the personal negativity and really start to focus the issues on the conflict at hand rather than letting this negativity spill over. That often requires a broader consideration. What earlier experiences did you bring into the relationship? What expectations did you have based on what you saw in your family or maybe even previous intimate relationships? Also, a lot of times we have to examine what is the context that the relationship is in. So relationships are very affected by the couple's, you know, just environment around them. How are things going with your financial situation? What is your day-to-day like? You know, is every day really stressful for you? Or is your life generally low hassle? And those environments, you know, there may need to be some changes to your environment as well that could help the relationship. So it's looking at, you know, how couples interact and communicate with each other, as well as being aware of the effect of their earlier experiences and looking at their day-to-day situations for major or repeated stressors. And it's looking at, you know, what is that interaction? How are those things working together? And we think that interaction really drives the course of the relationship and relates to its likelihood of success.
If we assume that there was a positive reason for entering into this relationship in the first place, how do we go about reconnecting with that?
Yes. So exactly, things that you can do to reconnect to that early experience. Seek out new experiences with your partner. That's one way you can try to get that novelty back. Invest in your relationship early on and throughout the course of your relationship. So for some people, it's easier to take our closest relationships for granted. And, you know, that's a real loss. If energy, and I think one point that goes along with that is to recognize that relationships do require effort and work. So things that were really easy on in our relationships, you know, may need additional attention and effort as time goes on. So each partner needs to take responsibility for devoting energy to keeping the emotional and physical affection in the relationship high. You need to make the time and commit the time to devote to your relationship because, as we all know, you know, life's other demands can are definitely competing for that time. Be agreeable and kind and good-natured with your partner. Again, even in the face of daily hassles or daily stress, because just providing a positive relationship or atmosphere for you and your partner can keep the relationship a positive place for both of you. And I would say look at how you kind of interact with your partner and engage with your partner as an investment, because keeping that those romantic feelings and that happiness can promote health benefits for you and your partner and people around you for years to come.
So where else would I look for, let's say, social interaction that would enhance my intimate relationship?
So there's overlap. If your intimate relationship is going well, then, you know, hopefully that relationship is situated in a context of friends where you have a shared social network or community relationships around you. Having close ties with extended family can be another way to kind of enhance your intimate relationship, because you can use your social network and other relationships around you to be a source of positivity and enjoyment in your intimate relationship. And to the extent that those relationships and networks overlap and can be beneficial to you and your partner, that's just another source of strength or another resource that you can draw from in your own relationship.
Not to approach a negative note too much, but at what point do you say enough is enough and it's time to abandon ship?
Yeah, that's a really important question. As positive as our relationships can be and as much as they can promote our health, you also need to be aware, is this relationship hurting you? Is it harmful? People should never expect aggression or violence. So even though I said that we, you know, will inevitably face differences or conflicts, that does not mean that abuse or physical or verbal aggression is ever acceptable, and people should definitely seek help for those types of issues. And in fact, that may be the safest course, is to end those relationships.
Final word of wisdom in terms of keeping that relationship on track, healthy, enjoyable, and fresh?
Have fun. Stay best friends with your partner. Take time for yourselves, especially when children come into your relationship. Make sure that you keep your relationship identity alive and strong, and have fun, and make sure to celebrate things like Valentine's Day coming up.
Lauren Papp, thanks for joining me for University of the Air.
Thank you.
She's a professor with the School of Human Ecology at the UW-Madison. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can be listening next time for University of the Air.